Yes, Honest Actors is back with brand new episodes every Friday. To help me continue releasing new episodes without a sponsor, or to say thanks for your favourite old ones, click the support link in the episode description. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. It's a one-off, feeling generous, good deed for the day sort of thing. Think of it as bumping into me and buying me a drink. To find out more, click the support link. Thanks for listening, and enjoy the show.
Yeah, mine's a large red.
I hate those guys.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
My name's Lucas Hare, and this is the Honest Actors Podcast.
It's like melted butter. That is. Hi, my name's Jonathan Harden, and you're listening to the Honest Actors Podcast. This is another brand new interview as part of Series 4, the series I never really truly intended to put out, but somehow has managed to exist. The other interviews are already on there. I think there's about 4 or 5 to date, plus 4 or 5 lockdown specials with past guests. Today I'm chatting to someone who I've chatted to about the podcast a lot in the past and who has a podcast of his own in which he talks about all things Bob Dylan. He's feeling a little bit nervous today, I hear, because he's not used to being on the other side of this. So today's guest is Lucas Hare, and I am about to click admit on Zoom. Oh my goodness, his head, your headshot just popped up there, Lucas Hare, before this. It's very Hello. Glamorous. How are you doing?
Well, I came in halfway, so you were saying something about me. It's like I just walked into a room and I wanted to know what you were saying.
I was saying that just before you popped up, not that you don't look glamorous and beautiful, your headshot popped up.
Oh, fucking hell.
And it looked very glamorous. And may I say, a little bit bad boy.
Well, I've tried my best.
And, you know, well, let us judge and see whether you're mis-selling yourself or not.
Well, there's like 2 days of stubble on there or something, and I look like I've got one or two demons. I've tried very hard to do that.
Yeah, you're looking. I mean, I can't. I almost want to hang up so I can see it again, but I'll enjoy it. I'll enjoy it post chat, and maybe if I can somehow screen grab it, I'll share it along with the episode, just so the listeners can also enjoy what can only be described as your version of Blue Steel. You're looking very well, and also, may I say, as backgrounds go for the listener, there is a well-stocked bookcase, a couple of antique chairs, a box, one can only assume, of family mementos, some VHS videos or books in the background, and some kind of turned, an upright piano.
God, you've made it all sound incredibly interesting and artistic. It's just stuff, most of which needs to be thrown away or dumped there, and that piano doesn't work, but let's not dwell on details.
Listen, I've just been reminded of something. Are you a direct descendant of Shakespeare? Because I've just noticed there is an oak beam, and I remember having a conversation with you in the past where your family are, you're basically somewhere really far back, you're related to Danny Dyer. Is that not true?
I am. I've done a lot of genealogy. Is it genealogy or genealogy? I never know. I've done a lot of that in the last few years. And if you take it far enough back, then there are some various people that you think, oh, I'm tenuously connected to that person. Not to Danny Dyer, not to Shakespeare. But yeah, you know, it's. I'm sure if they go far back enough.
I think genealogy proved quite some time ago that if we all go back far enough, we're all related to Danny Dyer. I'm open to contradiction on that, but only as a kind of offer of some kind of grace. I know I'm right. So I've asked you this before. I'm not going to ask you again. How are you keeping? How's lockdown been treating you and the Hare family?
I think okay, he said cautiously. I mean, I don't know anybody who's been stricken with the virus. So I'm living in that weird place where it just seems a bit strange and nothing particularly grim. I'm quite busy. I'm quite happy. I like being at home. I mean, this is the interesting thing. I'm sure I'm not the first person to say this, but you start to feel slightly guilty because you realize just how much it suits some personalities. And it's not that I'm a misanthrope or I'm a hermit, but, you know.
However,
I'm quite happy to just talk to people on the phone and, you know, video and not have to leave the house sometimes. It's a bit weird. I wasn't quite ready for
that. That must be something of a revelation for you, because I certainly wouldn't have put you in that category.
No, I think I'm just lazy. I think I like people and I like seeing people, but I live just outside London. So I've always got to go into London and then come back, and the trains are annoying and I don't drink. So there's that. And it's, you know, I'm really enjoying being at home, working a bit, recording my own podcast, doing this with you, doing things like that, done a bit of tidying, you know, I mean, it's okay. It sounds really bland to say that, but I'm not.
Do you think it will have changed you? Like, I would have imagined you are a dressing room door always open kind of guy. Do you think this may have turned you into a dressing room door closed, leave out on the in out boards, leave yourself as out, lock the dressing room door from the inside and pretend you're not there? Is that what lockdown has done to you? Is that the suggestion?
I hope not. I mean, I don't think I'm that person, but I am just very lazy about going out. I read something that your podcast alumnus John Joe O'Neill quoted on Twitter yesterday. So that if you don't have
podcast
any anxiety,
alumnus, I quite like that we have we have alumni.
We do indeed. They'll get, you know, funny hats. He said that he was quoting someone else, that if you don't experience anxiety during this lockdown, you're either an enlightened being or a psychopath.
Yep.
I don't think I'm either.
Right. So said a psychopath.
I suppose it must be. I'm not as anxious about stuff as I should be, given the fact that the trade we work in is burning to the ground as we speak. And, you know, there is quite possibly going to be very little salvage from it when we come back.
Do you know the really sad thing about 2020 is you say something like the trade we work in is burning to the ground, and I feel like, oh God, I haven't checked Twitter today. What's happened? Is this merely a metaphor? Or are the theatres literally burning to the ground?
It's merely a metaphor, you're fine. It's
for now. Just that. It's a metaphor for now. Well, as long as we can get a trade deal with Australia, we'll have reasonably priced Tim Tams in the future. So, you know, there's always that. I mean,
Oh God.
I mean, I just don't know where you begin if you're a satirist anymore. I just don't know how the thick of it, for example, would exist in 2020, because it would all just seem too real.
No, they would. I mean, this is very topical, and I know that's probably to be frowned on for recording a podcast, but just today, Dominic Raab was talking about taking the knee being something that's from Game of Thrones. Now, if you wrote that, you might be accused of going a little bit far, mightn't you? You know what I mean?
I don't know where to begin with topical stuff, which is why I generally try not to bother. I've been censoring the news, which is a good and a bad thing. I feel I have an elevated sense of the danger of coronavirus because I'm in Northern Ireland and actually there are less cases, but because I refuse to listen to local news because it just makes me furious. Yeah. I feel like I'm living in the northeast of England where apparently the R number is relatively high. And so that's the rest of our family are all very relaxed about this. Very relaxed, all want to, you know, do go back to some kind of normality. And I think we have an elevated sense, perhaps of the danger of it. Although to me, it just seems totally logical to wait and see for a couple of weeks what the reducing restrictions means in terms of the transmission of the virus that takes 2 weeks to really show itself. So, we've isolated ourselves from our families for a little bit longer while they've all, I think, been moving towards seeing each other.
Yeah, I mean, it's important to console yourself with the fact that nobody knows anything, and that can either be the most enlightening or the most frightening thing you're likely to hear. And as you say, I think a bit of caution is very, very wise. Lots of people have said to me in the last few months, what can we do now? What have they said we can do now? What's allowed? And my answer is always, well, I'll go with the common sense in my own head based on a little reading around the truth and science rather than what this horrible government is telling us to do.
That is the bit that really gets to me, is like, what point did we start waiting for them to go, And now the pubs can open in 2 weeks. And you think, oh, brilliant. That's good, isn't it? And then you go and look at the World Health Organization and think, not sure that's really, that's another one of those test. No, thanks. We're good for tests. Mm. I hear also the app won't be ready till Christmas, but it's no big deal. I mean, come on. This is a different podcast. Thank you very much for agreeing to do the podcast we're recording at the moment, which although listeners may be confused, is not in fact the politics podcast. It is the Honest Actors podcast. Tell us this, Lucas Hare, if you wouldn't mind. How did you get into acting?
I was thinking about this, and every time I think about it, I realize it started earlier than I'd always thought. I always thought I started when I was about 12, and then I realized I remembered I did a school play when I was 10. And then I remember the year before that, I tried to get involved, and they stuck me backstage. And then I remembered...
The year before I won an Olivier.
Yes, exactly.
For my one-man show.
Invented the theatre. I think I was about 7 or 8, and it was my first... God, it was my first term at boarding school. Yes, I was 7. And they were doing, I think, Tom Sawyer. And at some point, somebody used a knife. And I'd already opened, I'd already seen it. But I went to the teacher in charge the next day and I said, I've got a really good knife that you could use. And which is, I don't know, I've misremembered this because I'd quite clearly seen it already and they didn't want to accept new props at that stage. But they said, yes, please bring it in. That'd be exciting. And I did. Bollocks. It can't have opened. It must have been a rehearsal or something. Anyway, I lent them my knife and it was a plastic, you know, toy. And I just wanted to be part of it. And then a few years later, again, I said to someone in charge of the play, is there anything I can do? And I'd left it far too late. And they said, well, you can just be backstage and watch the lighting and sound guys and maybe learn a bit. But thank you for your interest kind of thing. And then the next year, they gave me the
same ever since.
Exactly. And then I played the lead part in a play the next year. Now I was 12. So by the time I was 14, I thought, this would be fun if I could do this for a living.
So listen, boarding school is a whole other world to me. It's not something I don't think I've ever had a discussion with any of my friends about going to boarding school. So I don't even know if many of my friends have. I knew you had, I think. But do you think that experience is any different in terms of like if you're a performing kid, if you're a kid who likes to make other people laugh, was that you? Or were you a shy, retiring guy who got a chance once in a blue moon to go on stage and be somebody else?
In all honesty, I think I was both. I think I was very shy and very inward, but occasionally I would find myself impersonating one of the teachers and somebody would say, oh, you should do that. And that was the only time I felt confident. And that goes right through to all of my teens when nobody feels confident about anything. And I was doing at least a play a term, if not two, because it was somewhere where I felt confident and surrounded by teenage boys and girls. I didn't really.
Those things, I guess, have more currency in a boarding context whenever you're not going home. And so you have to find your place within the group, I guess, not just during class hours.
And also, you know, it was a big fuck off private boarding school. So it had great facilities. So if you expressed interest in doing a play, there was I didn't study GCSE drama or A-level drama. That wasn't available to me. If you wanted to do a play, you'd go up to the teacher in charge of the theatre and say, can I book the theatre to do this play? When's it free? And they say, yeah, sure.
That's amazing.
And then you get in there and the seating would be movable so you could have the stage wherever you wanted. I mean, that was ludicrously kind of privileged.
So this is really interesting to me because I was re-listening, as it happens, to John Joe O'Neill because somebody tweeted about how much they'd enjoyed it. And usually if somebody tweets something like that, it makes me go, I've never listened to that episode. Yeah. Since I edited it together. And so you have a very strange sense because something in your brain can't remember which bits are in and which bits are out, apart from the really standout moments. And so I listened back to it and laughed a lot at the fact that I seemed like a school child and was very excited to be in a dressing room with John Joe. And But one of the things that was interesting was we talked about that one of the things that facilitated his becoming an actor was the fact there were zero expectations on him to be anything else. Mm. Now, I imagine if you go to, in your words, a fuck off, was it a fuck off boarding school, private school?
That's the specific.
That's what it says on the sign anyway, at the bottom of the very long lane.
Yeah. I guess the opposite to most people, I would imagine.
I guess the opposite is true to you then. I guess there was a level of expectation that was, the school has a theatre, yes, but we don't study theatre because probably, I mean, I'm making a level of assumption here, there's no academic value in it. But it's an extracurricular thing. Go ahead, enjoy it. We have a theatre with some movable seats, but under no circumstances imagine that this is something that you should pursue professionally. Is that a fair assumption? Or if I'm painting too simplified a picture, what is the kind of more rounded one?
No, that is a fair assumption. I mean, I was studying English, history and art A-level, and the closer you get to adulthood and your teacher's expectations that you're going to be making some kind of decisions about this sort of thing fairly soon, you know, that point gets closer and closer. And I remember going on to my art teacher and saying, actually, you know, I know that I quite enjoy art and stuff, but I think I'm going to be an actor. And he looked incredibly disappointed. And that was another artistic calling, giving way to acting. So the academic thing, I don't know. I mean, English, I enjoyed English A-level so much because we were doing things like Shakespeare, frankly. And that seemed very connected and holistic and part of it all. But most people who go to those kinds of schools go into banking or they go into the government or, you know, so there's that level of expectation.
So,
and I didn't really want to be part of that at all.
So if that's the case, then did you have the support of your family? Like at what point, what age were you when you met that art teacher?
17, 18, probably.
So I imagine then either close to that, either before or after, you also had a similar conversation with your family.
Yeah.
And how did that go? I mean, is that a bit of to a lesser degree, obviously, is that a bit of a coming out to say, listen, that you've spent all this money, I went to this great school, and what I would really like to do is be one of 60,000 unemployed actors in the UK.
It's funny, now that you put it like that, that makes sense of their reactions. no, I mean... My
you probably didn't phrase it like that. I mean, I certainly
no, I
wouldn't.
I didn't, but how very articulate of you to put it like that. It's absolutely true. My parents got divorced when I was about 10, and my dad paid the school fees for as long as he could. And he'd also gone to a big fuck-off English boarding private school, but had not really gone into anything particularly notable. But when I told him, he was very... Well, I would now say realistic. At the time, I thought he was probably being a bit negative in telling me that I should have something to fall back on, et cetera, et cetera. Whereas my mum, who was the youngest of four children and always, always had to deal with the fact that she was the youngest and female and therefore her opinion never counted for anything, said to me, I will support you in whatever you do. And it wasn't until I actually started becoming an actor that I realized that she meant that. It's not just something parents say. And they're both no longer alive. And I very much wish I could kind of show my mum some of the things that I've done since. She'd be chuffed a bit, you know.
And was there any history of it in your family? Was there a kind of I mean, not even to a professional level, was there a footlightsy kind of vibe to any of your uncles or aunts or, you know, that kind of?
No, I've got a cousin called Rebecca who went to Lambda, which is where I went to, and she was about 10 years ahead of me. And so when I was getting interested in acting and drama school, I would ask her and she would give me little bits of advice.
Did she ever advise you not to do it?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Did it leave a mark? Did you even consider her advice at that point?
No, because, you know, if you're that age, you know everything, don't you? And you think that you're going to be different. And you think that you're going to be famous or successful or both, and which is great. You know, why shouldn't young people think that? But now, from the vantage point of my late 40s, I can see how ridiculous that was.
And what did you expect of a career at that point then. If your cousin's saying, listen, you know, this and that, here's some advice, but yeah, it's not really a great path and it's difficult. And if I was to do it all over again, I might consider this, or have you thought about teaching or any of those things that people do? What were your expectations in contrary to that?
Well, it's what I would say to my children now. And that's to quote the Beach Boys, Brian Wilson song, I know there's an answer, but I have to find it by myself. There's absolutely no point telling people that, because they will discover that you are right, but they have to do it for themselves.
Look at you quoting the Beach Boys. That's so on brand. For anybody that doesn't know you, that's very on brand for the man that has a Bob Dylan podcast. Very, thank very you. On brand.
Yeah, my life is punctuated by banal pop lyrics, but I do believe that. I do believe that, you know, your experience of something is very often not the only meaningful thing, but someone can tell you something that's the truth. And until you actually go through it yourself, you're just not going to take it on board.
So what did you expect as you embarked upon a career, as you embarked upon training? What did you expect would happen when you came out of that training at Lambda?
I don't know. I think my mistake was not to be, there must have been some kind of complacency there and not enough ambition, because to this day, I don't think I'm ambitious enough. And yet I think it never occurred to me that I would leave drama school and then really have to fight for this. I thought, in my stupid naivety, I've gone to one of the best drama schools in the country. I'm leaving now. I'm young. There are lots of possibilities. And I didn't fall into it. And I thought, I mean, they probably do now, but at that time, they didn't really prepare you for the fact that the day after, or the week after your graduation, you're going to be sitting there looking at the phone going, oh, I'm waiting for you to ring, am I? Shit.
Yeah. It's interesting. Paul Higgins and I had a chat a few weeks ago. I know you've heard it. Mm-hmm. But one of the things that came up in that discussion, and there's always something in these chats that's brand new, as much as the questions are pretty much formulaic, there's always something that's brand new. And one of the things that occurred to me during the interview with Paul that was brand new was that people give up a lot to go to drama school personally, that they separate themselves from their friends quite often if they're not from London, and if they're traveling out, even if that commute's only an hour, that they're away from family and friends, and that when they come out and they try and find themselves somewhere to live in London, they're skint, they're unemployed, and they don't have a support network. So if you know, I don't know where in particular, whether you were in London at the time or not.
Yeah.
But it does seem that one of the things that people are very ill prepared for is that coming out into the world of drama school. And although you'll be told, as you say, 100 times during drama school, you know, it's not easy, guys. And you know, you're going to be unemployed when you come out of here. That little part of your mind that says, yeah, but not me. I'm going to be the guy in the class that's going to be okay. Yeah. Everyone else might be unemployed, but I'll be fine.
Yeah.
How did you find that first little period, or was it cut short by a job?
Well, I went up for an audition for something, and this was definitely within 2 months or even a month of leaving Lambda. And the guy who saw me said, you're not right for this, but I've got something else I'm thinking of. And it was not a good job. It was a fine first job, but it was a real come down. So I did that, and then I did a play the following year, which again was a bit of a come down in terms of my expectations. I had a pretty good part, but then I discovered the small print that I was also doing light stage management duties, which I had not realized I was meant to be doing. Then I found out I was being paid less, you know, as a result. And so that was a bit of a come down. And then I had about 11 months of unemployment, and those three experiences together were very, very sobering. And when I came out the other side, it's funny, you know, Colin Cook, who was head of acting at Lambda, said, it's not a 3-year training, it's a 7-year training. Which is to say, you carry on learning for at least another 4 years after you leave. And it's something I think about all the time. Like driving, I suppose, you may pass your test, but you're still learning for those next few years how to drive at night, drive on motorways, drive in the rain, you know, all sorts of things that you hadn't been prepared for. And so that learning experience went on for a long time after I left drama school. And yeah, you discover a few things that were a little less rose-tinted than maybe you'd assumed.
Okay, before we go down that dark, winding path, I think it's important to do some other Honest Actors podcast business. Too much Adam Buxton. Anyway, here we are.
Yeah.
Before we go into dark, you're too keen for this dark and winding path.
I want dark content. You know, I need a good meaty part. This is tough.
You do need some dark content. We're going to go dark. Don't worry. But before we do that, there's the question of if you were to be defined by a single job or two along the way, the kind of work you like to do, the kind of work you'd like to be known for, or something that just stands out as being important to you, what jobs might appear at the top of that list? And that's my usual kind of gently phrased get out clause for anybody who feels offended when they go, fuck him, he didn't mention that show we did.
Yeah. Well, there are two shows that I would say were very important to me, and I think I can honestly say that neither of them had anything to do with the work I was doing in them. So I'm not proud of my work in them, but they were formative. The first is, I guess, near the end of that 7-year period that we're talking about, late 98, I was in a production of Twelfth Night at the Sheffield Crucible, directed by Michael Grandage. And I had two utterly inconsequential parts, but I learned, sorry, Lambda, I learned how to do Shakespeare on that job, and it's never left me. And I looked around me and I looked at the way that production was being done, and I thought, this is how you fucking do it. You know, I remember Michael Grandage saying in rehearsal, he said, we've got something here. He said, it's light on its feet. And I thought, that's an interesting phrase. And that's exactly what it was. It never, you know, crowbarred you over the head. It was incredibly deft. It was very enjoyable. And they have this thing in Sheffield that I think they still do. They certainly did in 98, called a pound preview, where they would just, all tickets would be £1. And he said to us the night before, he said, no pressure, but this is what the show will die or live on, is word on the street, depending on what's happened with this pound preview, because anyone comes. And if people on the streets of Sheffield like it, you're okay. And they did, because it was utterly accessible, and it was never patronizing, and it was never difficult. And it was just great fun. And there was some, I mean, to this day, I look at people like, I mean, Malcolm Sinclair played Malvolio.
I'm glad it was a comedy. I thought you were going to say, you know, played Hamlet there. And I was going to say, that would be interesting. A light on his feet, Hamlet.
Yeah. But God, it was good. It was, and I can say that because I was barely in it. Eunice Stubbs was in it. Hermione Gulliford. It was just a wonderful, wonderful production. And like I say, my opinion of Shakespeare and how it should be performed has not deviated from what I learned on that job over 20 years ago.
Yeah. So you stopped learning.
Yeah. I mean, I thought, this is how you do it. This is absolutely how you do it. The other one I would say would have to be by default, because I've done 500 performances of it, is The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime. I did the first English and Irish national tour. And I did and then another 6 months or so in the West End a couple of years later. And that was a very, very important experience, because here was a play that in 2014-15 had been done at the National 2 years previous, and had been in the West End. And it just made you think, well, surely everyone's seen this. This is done and dusted, right? No. Not at all. And we were sat down at the beginning by Rufus Norris, and he said, this is what the National Theatre is meant to be doing, which is being national. We're taking this stuff out around the country, and we're giving it to people that won't have had a chance to see it yet. And you realise, when you're playing to 2,000 people a night in Liverpool or Aberdeen, and the response in these places, and what it means to people, it was just a fantastic lesson in how important theatre is. Kids would come who'd never been to the theatre before, people who identified with the protagonist, who were on the autistic spectrum, would write letters and say, I'm bringing my family to see this next week so that they can understand me better. You know, it just really, really humbled you. That was special.
It's pretty, two pretty good choices. It's almost like you thought about that in advance. Like, it's like you prepared. It's somebody off screen, I can just see holding up cards, Bob Dylan style.
I know. Well, it's almost like you've been doing this podcast for 5 years and you ask the same questions every time. I mean,
Don't interrupt me. I was looking at my questions. One second. What's the one project you're most proud of? He's done that one. Do you enjoy auditions? Do you agonize over them afterwards?
Which one do you want? Do I enjoy auditions? I thought about this, and sometimes is the answer. I've thought about this a lot, and they are awful sometimes. But if they're worth it, if you genuinely feel like you've had a chance to show a little bit of yourself and then build the relationship that comes afterwards from that first brick, then I think that was wonderful. I did my worst audition was, and I only mentioned this because I just was recently reminded of it because another actor went through exactly the same thing for the same production. And it was a fairly high profile, it was a fairly high profile production at a very high profile place with a very high profile director. Ah. And so I'd prepared a couple of scenes, a couple of parts, and I got there. And we did that chatting thing with the director, you know, which you always think is just breaking the ice. But, you know, really, you're as nervous about that as you are about anything. And we did that. And that seems to be going fine. And then he said, you probably will have heard, I don't get actors to read as a rule. So thanks for coming in. And I was utterly befuddled and crestfallen because I'd prepared for this, you know, and all we'd done was 10 minutes of talking about mutual friends and people that we knew and all productions we'd seen. I thought, you've not even given me the chance. And I just tried to forget about it because ultimately there was nothing I could have done about it until I worked with an actor last year who told that exact same story. And we both felt vindicated that it wasn't our fault. And we've been carrying this around for about 5-6 years. And we just, in that moment, realized that what must have happened is the production must have been cast, but there was another day of auditions that they had to get through. And they just thought they'd do it as quickly as they could. It was painful. But when I heard this other actor tell me, I thought, oh, thank fuck. It wasn't me.
There are directors who don't get you, some very well-known directors who don't get people to act. They observe them.
Yeah, but they don't ask you to prepare and then tell you that they're not going to use it.
I mean, yeah, you said you'd prepared. You didn't say you were asked. Where I thought maybe he was...
I was instructed to prepare a couple of scenes.
Right. That is hard.
That was horrible. It was just horrible. You know.
That's hard.
But there is a kind of Zen-like thing with auditions. As John Joe was saying about Bryan Cranston and George Clooney, they have this great advice about, you know, you're gambling with house money. It's a learning experience. You walk out with nothing. It's the same as what you walked in with, et cetera, et cetera. But actually, if there's nothing you could have done, that's quite freeing. Because you can say to yourself, well, there's nothing I could have changed to make that better for myself.
Mm.
But that's what a person who's completely rejected and depressed would say. I don't know.
It's a tough one, isn't it? Like, I mean, it's really interesting. These questions are now like 5 years old. As you pointed out, they have been, I mean, this file is called Podcast Questions Series 3. So I did kind of go through them each year and think, well, what ones? And I should probably go back to the start and maybe reinstate a few. But they kind of evolve with me. So oddly, the question about auditions now, I think, well, it depends on the audition because I like them, not when I get them, but I like them when the person who's conducting them is nice and courteous and interested. Mm. And I dislike them when they're not. And it's like auditions themselves, it's not the audition per se, it's the interaction, and the interaction is entirely subject to the human at the other side of it. And of course me as well, if I'm having a bad day or I haven't prepared as much as I think I should, then I might go in with a chip on my shoulder. That's happened. But it just, you know, it's interesting that you say that about the questions, and actually as you're saying that, I'm like, it does just depend, doesn't it? You can have an absolute stinker, and at the same time you can come out of an audition thinking, as I have done, phone my agent and said, I didn't get it, but I think I did okay. Like, I'm pleased because someone who I wanted to impress, I feel, has went, he's all right. Mm. And that's enough.
And that's important, because if you can take that from the audition, then you're not hanging everything on the did I get the job. you're using the audition for purposes, you know, for which you can learn, you can grow, you can adapt. And I think if you can phone or email your agent or whatever afterwards and say, almost certainly didn't get it, but you know what, I did the best I possibly could and I felt it went fine, but I don't think I'm going to get it, then that's for me, that's a positive because you've learned something.
Yeah. And as I always used to say back in the day, I haven't said it in a long time, I've just been reminded, you're auditioning for more auditions. You're not auditioning for that part. You're auditioning for that casting director, that director who will not just do one thing in 3 years' time, 4 years' time, 10 years' time. You've got to hope that they'll go, do you know who'd be great for that? That guy who wasn't quite right 10 years ago.
Yeah,
anyway.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely.
I'm going to read them all like this just because you said I don't have all my questions. Do you know when an audition has gone well? No, I'm not going to ask that one. It's a terrible question.
I thought I did until I went to one and the director looked so unbelievably moved and sincere and I didn't get it. And I thought, oh, okay, well,
see, this is difficult. This is difficult because having just directed again for the first time in years on stage, and having gone through auditions where some people came in who just weren't right, but you know you've got 20 minutes put aside and you know they prepared, so you're going to direct them in the scenes because that's what you do. And in some cases people came in who I didn't think were amazing and you're still going, well, they came here, they prepared, they deserve to get me to direct them through the scenes. And you can't really in an audition go, you're not getting it. No more than you can in the rehearsal room. So you have to say positive things like, oh, that's actually, you know, I feel that's much better. It feels much stronger working like that. And you can see how then actually what you're doing is just giving people hope.
Yeah.
So it's a really difficult line. I think on the other side of it, if you're sensitive to actors, it's actually really hard to not give people hope because what you don't want to do is go, what you do want to do is just be bluntly honest and say, listen, this isn't working. I don't think you're going to get this. You know, what I should have said to some people, and this is interesting as well, is you need new headshots.
Yeah.
Because you look nothing like them. Or, your headshot gives an impression of an entirely different person. And I brought you in because I wanted that person and you're not that person. So it's a classic. It is a real classic misdemeanor, like a real, you know, your headshots are the actor you want to be rather than the actor you are. And...
Well, there's a great mistake, I think, that a lot of people think they can go through life being positive, and that is in some way itself a good thing. But like you say, if it offers someone false hope, that's incredibly cruel and unrealistic.
Yeah.
And I think it's easier socially and in auditions for people to pretend to be positive about something than anything. I mean, you know, it's a useful skill. I went to a film premiere once with a friend who worked on the film. And we watched it and it was fucking awful. And he turned to me and he said, right, now comes the difficult bit. Now we've got to go to the party and talk about opening weekends and how everyone's going to love it and all that. And it was brilliant. He did it. And I just sort of nodded at him. But it's a really important skill. It's really, but it's just shockingly fake and horrible. And in an audition situation to give, as you say, give an actor the hope that they think they did it right, just so that you stay positive, whatever that means, is cruel.
I don't know, man. I don't know. Like, I've So what do you? Yeah, I don't know. I always say as well, if someone's good, you have to say they're good. And then the flip side is, if someone's really brilliant, I will say that was really brilliant. And then of course they leave going, I got that, but it doesn't mean you were brilliant for the part. It just means you're brilliant. Like, you know, it's so hard because I think people on the other side, if they're nice people, feel exactly the same levels of anxiety over how they're presenting themselves, but also about how they're managing your experience. Because I think people are mostly sensitive to actors' needs within certainly theatre. Like theatre's the best, then film, then TV, and then at the very bottom, it's like commercials where they couldn't give a flying fuck if you're about to have a breakdown.
And that can be after they've employed you. I mean,
you know what I mean? We're running an hour behind. Fuck off now.
Yeah.
Anyway. Do you have then friends that you would consider to be rivals, people who you see at auditions who you dread to see because you think, oh God, they'll get it? Or, you know, have you been able to separate your own skill set from those of the people that you consider to be similar to you?
I think I don't separate my own skill set from other people. I don't think I'm, you know, special. There are lots of actors who are right for things and lots of actors who aren't. I don't really feel, this is going to sound like what I said earlier on about John Joe's enlightened beings. I don't really feel envy, I don't think, anymore. And going back to what I was saying earlier, maybe I should be more ambitious, more driven. But I don't, you know, I don't really, I mean, once in a while I've gone on, up for a self-tape that is just ludicrously out of my league, but I thought, well, it's nice to do. And then, of course, because it's quite high profile, you get to watch the film a couple of years later and see the person they actually gave the part to. And if it's someone much more famous, I don't feel jealous of them. I just think, well, that's the way it works. They obviously decided they wanted someone, you know, known in that part.
Ah, but you see, in a way, the fame thing is a bit like, yeah, I think that's a given, right? So if you watch the film and they've went with Cameron Diaz, you think, well, that was never going to be me, right? They've changed the character, right? And she's more famous. Some would say arguably easier on the eye than you. Although I think your headshot is absolutely smoking, Luke.
My brother took that shot. I better give him a plug. His name's Sam. Yep.
Sam Herr, very good musician as well.
Hey, oh, you are kind. You're lucky for that.
So I think that's a red herring because I guess it's more about like you go to the audition, you don't get it, and then one of your peers gets it and you see them in it.
Yeah, okay.
Because that can go one of two ways. Either it can be really difficult or you can go, as I think I said last week, thank God it was one of us and not one of them. Thank God it was one of the underlings.
That's not really happened. I mean, I certainly would try and resist any feelings of envy. I just don't think it's just one of those emotions, which is a bit of a cul-de-sac. That sounds impossibly kind of superior and naive at the same time, but I think I've managed to escape envy. I think.
Okay. So then let's assume that you get the job and that rules envy out of the picture entirely. The famous, an agent once told me, do you know what, a friend of mine, one of my very good friends, I really hope he listens to this. He's not an actor. And I've got two good friends from school and one of them has been listening to the podcast from the start and quite likes it, right? And he's, you know, the two of them are both guys who used to work in a video store, right? That gives you the kind of sense of they're really into films and they're interested in actors. And they're the kind of people who would be interested in an interview like this with an actor they do or don't know. That's right up their street. So one of them had been listening to the show for years and the other one had just been kind of silent in those conversations on WhatsApp and not said much. But because I'm an egotistical maniac, I thought perhaps he was just shy, didn't want to tell me how much he loved it. But turns out he hadn't listened to a single fucking podcast. Cue Paul Higgins went out the other week and for some reason he tuned into Paul Higgins. Mm. And he outed himself by saying to me, oh, I really like that Paul Higgins episode, mate. That bit where you said, an agent once told me, I thought that was brilliant. Mm. And I said, So an agent once told me, Patrick Duncan is his name. I'll do the voice, why not? Johnny, an actor's only ever truly happy when they get the job. And then 5 minutes later, the doubt kicks in. And the reason why he sounds slightly English and slightly Northern Irish is because he is Northern Irish and he went to public school and went to Cambridge. But do you recognise yourself in that?
Completely. Yeah. I can see myself now. I can see myself now walking down roads out of shifts at pissy jobs, calling my wife and saying, I've got this job, or tentatively saying, should I accept this job? And I know in my voice is a kind of presumption that says, this is going to make everything better. This will clear all my debts. This means I am working, therefore I am happy. End of story. And that lasts such a brief amount of time, because then of course you realize that it's going to end just as surely as it's going to start. And well, I think it was one of your things a few years ago when you were asking people to come up with very good little pearls of wisdom. And the one that really stuck with me was learn to live like a pauper, especially when you're working.
Bram Mel Donaghy.
Fucking superb. Yep. I mean, that's never left me, because what you've got to do when you get that job, instead of, you know, having the downward slope of then realizing that it's going to end and you're going to be, you know, hurtled back into a horrible job and crushing debt, is just treat it as another bit of unemployment, but one you're working in, I suppose. Mm-hmm. If you stop treating it like a fix, then maybe your expectations won't be so.
The great thing about that, that was Bramwell, a friend of mine had said that, who again, I should probably get on the show, he's brilliant. But Bramwell had said that, and it just made sense to me, because it's a way of managing the peak. So what you don't have is a peak that is, I'm working, aren't I great? And a peak that is, I'm going out and spending money and going for dinner and buying things and all the rest of it. Not necessarily that you're flush with cash, but that you have a bit more disposable income and you're going out and spending it. And in actual fact, if you allow the job to be its own peak,
and there are
no surrounding kind of associated peaks of going out and getting, you know, absolutely hammered or all that stuff that people do whenever they're working, then when you're not working, you might be able to afford to go and do the things you need to do to lift you out of that post-work mental lull, doldrums, depression. And it is brilliant. I am incapable of, however, of actually doing it, because
it's really tough.
I'm working, I just want to celebrate the fact that I'm working. And so I always think about that thing. Funny enough, I've always thought about that as well. Why can't I live like a pauper when I'm working? Because I would never try to live like a pauper all the time.
You feel you've deserved it. That's why. You've had these months in the wilderness, and then someone gives you the thing that you've been praying for or hoping for, and it arrives. And already, just by using those words, you're treating it as some kind of transformative experience where rules don't apply. I can eat out. I'll be in London. I'll do this. And it's nonsensical. You're just setting yourself up for a fall, you know. Yeah.
By the pyramid.
Absolutely.
And just, you know, champagne for all my friends.
Agents sometimes do it. Not my wonderful current agent, but I've had agents in the past that said, you know, it's a job in town. You'll be able to do TV and radio and voiceovers and stuff while you're in town. That's never happened. But you kind of get yourself into this mentality where suddenly you're like, you're like Toast of London. You know, you've got a voiceover in the morning and then you've got a thing in the afternoon and you're then, you know, eating at your club and just having a wonderful time. It's ludicrous. There's a lesson in that Toast of London thing. I was watching just channel hopping last night and I heard Matt Berry doing a voiceover, which of course he did lots of voiceovers before Toast of London. But since Toast of London, he's obviously been asked to do voiceovers a bit like that. Yeah.
Money Superman.
That was the one. I thought you've gone beyond parody. I mean, fair play. You've done a fantastic job there. You've set up something satirical that then people wanted to invest in. That's a hell of a thing to do.
Do you get nervous? So coming off that phone call and then suffering from self-doubt and then getting into the job and then getting to the point where I've got to put this in front of an audience. Do you, or have you ever suffered from any kind of stage fright?
Kind of. I didn't do any theatre for 9 years once, and then I did a year-long tour, and I was pretty nervous going on stage that night. But I was also drinking, and I think, as most actors on tour are, and I'm not going to normalise it, it's just that's what fucking happens, and it's so harmful. But since I stopped drinking a couple of years ago, the nerves have, well, they haven't left me, but the anxiety's gone down by about 80%.
Do you know what's really good for anxiety? A wee gin and tonic.
Now, I'm not even going to laugh at that, because it's jokes like that. You're smiling like a mischievous little fucker.
It is interesting. People would say that, right? So anxiety would be, take the edge off anxiety with a drink. Of course, under normal circumstances in 2020, you can't really take a couple of gin and tonics before you go on stage, but there are people who will do it. There are people who will have a little sneaky swig of something before they go on stage. What's your kind of experience of that then, in terms of the difference between when you were drinking versus when you're not? What do you think's different about your mental state because of that change?
I think I'm a you know, I think I've changed quite a lot since then. I'm not sure what people around me would say, but I stopped drinking in January 2018 because I'd just done two theatre jobs on the trot, and I reckon I drank after every single show of both of them, which again, you know, within theatre circles might not sound that strange, but that's not good for you. And I finished the second job and I was incredibly fatigued at home. I was trying to get back to a normal life and I just wanted to go to sleep all the time. And I rang the doctor and they said, well, let's maybe take your blood test and we'll see what happens. And so often, you know, you have those blood tests and you ring the surgery and, you know, for your test results on a Friday or whatever. And they always say, no further action to be taken. And that's all you ever get. You don't get any more information. And I rang for this appointment and was waiting for the receptionist to say no further action to be taken. And she said, yes, the doctor would like to ring you. Is that all right?
A recall. You got a recall.
Yeah. Either a recall or a death sentence. Either, you know, one or the other. I thought, fucking hell. Shit. Am I unhealthy now?
And I rang. Yeah, I'm sure if you're like me, you go to the worst possible worst case scenario,
totally.
Right?
Oh,
yeah.
Totally.
The weight is killer.
Age. Yeah, no, my mum died when she was 47 and I was 46 at the time and I was thinking, fuck, is this it? Is this my time?
Wow.
And I rang the doctor and he said, well, your liver's not great. That was how he said it. And I thought, okay. He said, right. I said, well, I'll stop drinking. He said, well, no, you don't need to stop. You need to take it easy for a bit, you know. And I said, no, I'm going to, well.
How many units a week are you taking, Mr. Hare?
Well, this is the thing. I mean,
what's a unit, doctor?
I know, but I said, look, I've done two theatre jobs back to back, and then it was Christmas. Of course, my liver is full of whiskey. You can say, man.
I have a small glass of wine when I come off stage at the end of the first scene.
Just wind down.
Then I go back on for the third scene. I have another small glass of white and possibly a chaser.
Yeah, but I mean, we laugh. But I remember, never forget, a casting director who I've got a lot of time for said this on Twitter a few years ago. She said she went to the doctor and the doctor said, "How many units of alcohol do you have per week?" And she looked at him and said, "I work in theatre," and that's, you know, incredibly truthful and incredibly funny. There is this.
That's a dark and winding. We've just found ourselves on the dark and winding road, Lucas.
Oh, good. And so anyway, I was, despite my trying to normalize the fact that I had a whiskey after every show for several months and then Christmas and then was wondering why my liver wasn't in great shape, I decided I'd stop at least for a month or so until I could have a scan and see if my liver had repaired itself. And within days, I happened to be reading something about antidepressants. And at the time they were... You know, they were talking about, do antidepressants work? Do people rely on them? Are they a good thing? Yada, yada, yada. And I thought, antidepressants. I have, my entire life, people have told me that alcohol is a depressant, but not until this very second has it occurred to me that sobriety is an antidepressant. And that's what I'm on now. And that's why I feel better. Oh, fuck. And from that moment, I thought, well, I'm not going back to this. This is, why the fuck would I go back? If I've now realized that's the way I stop 80% of my anxiety. And I went further. I thought, fuck, have I been depressed for 20 years? Did I just think I had this sort of slightly dry, dark, twisted view on life, but I was actually depressed? And it, for me, I don't think alcohol is necessarily the cause of that, but it is petrol on a fire in my experience. And it just, I think it's important within... It's important for me to say that this is my experience. This is not the answer, but it's my answer. And I think within the context of actors, many of whom drink a lot and many of whom suffer from anxiety about where their next job is coming from, it might be something worth flagging. That's why I don't get as nervous as I used to. That said, I do need a little bit of adrenaline before I go on. Otherwise, that's just awful, as I'm sure you agree. You want to have a little bit of butterflies.
So just run around the foyer in the nip, or what do you do?
I don't know. Normally it works. Normally the sound of the audience or whatever will be enough to kind of give me that little bit of a buzz.
Yeah.
But I'm not terrified anymore, which is a good thing.
Yeah. I mean, what happens if there's not very many audience? What happens if theatre audiences are down to like a six because of social distancing and you turn up the show relay full blast and all you hear is
oh, fuck. Yeah.
Well, the then, last you get, then you would get nervous, right?
Yeah. The last play I did was in the vaults underneath the Waterloo Station. And the audience are closer to you than some of the actors. That's not an exaggeration. And we all went out at the beginning. And there was a sagging bit in the middle of the run when I think I've forgotten the figures now because they're too disturbing, but I think we did weekend shows, and I think in the space of four, I think all two shows on Saturday and one show on a Sunday, I think we played to 100 people in total once, and it was awful. But they're lit, they're close, you yeah. can see, and yep. you can see they're yep. asleep sometimes, you can yep. really see them.
Yep, especially in the madness.
Yeah, and you thought, fuck, I can't afford to be anxious about this. I can't afford to have the scene that I've prepared and I'm now doing derailed by the fact that someone's asleep in front of me.
Yeah.
So I can't, yeah, so there is a little bit of nerves. There's some nerves where we are.
Okay, so do you believe in big breaks? Have you had yours? Have you ever thought you were on the brink of one? Or even in the midst of one?
I don't think. Well, they've never existed for me. And someone said to me just last week, what you need, Luke, is a big break, don't you? And my answer is always, yeah, and then another one. And another one after that. Because I've never, some people have, and, you know, that's great. I've never experienced that moment in my career where momentum takes over.
Have you ever thought it might? Have you ever thought, well, this is the moment, surely momentum will follow?
There was a moment, and again, it was just after I stopped drinking, and that can't be an accident, where I got a new agent and I did several TV jobs, and I was in the West End and booked for 2 days of filming as well. And everything was happening at once, and it was wonderful. I thought, I've got to remember this because this is not going to happen again. But I was running out of stage door into a waiting black Mercedes to be driven down to a hotel for a day of filming and then driven back for the half and then again the next day. And that felt like momentum. That felt like I was busy. But I also knew that I should pinch myself and not get used to it. Mm. So I don't think, no, I think it, big breaks, if they do exist, then I'd love to have one. But I think, to me, one of the greatest shocks about becoming an actor is that there wasn't, when you finish working, you don't go back to the same rung on the ladder that you were when you were last unemployed. You just go back to the bottom again most of the time. You might be a couple of rungs up after a few years, but that was tough. That sort of up, down, snakes and ladders existence.
Snakes.
Yeah, exactly. In that sense, you need more than one big break, that's for sure.
What's the longest you've gone without work? You mentioned 11 months earlier and you mentioned 9 years without doing theatre.
Yeah, those are the two big ones. The 11 months was a shock because I was only a year or so out of drama school. The 9 years of theatre was sort of my own doing in that I went to do a play in the late 90s in Hull, a Hull truck, and my daughter was very young at the time, and that was the time when I, just after that 12th night, actually, about a year later, that was the time when I realized just how destructive to a young child's life that kind of lifestyle was. So I said to my agent, look, could we maybe just take it easy on the theater in faraway cities just for a bit, just until she's a bit older? And as a parent, that was the best thing I could have done. As an actor, it was the worst thing I could have done because then nothing really happened for a long, long time. But it meant I had time. There were a couple of jobs in there, a couple of filming jobs, which are still entertaining to talk about to this day. But basically I was around to bring up my son when he was born. I went to university and did a degree and contemplated that maybe this wasn't the best thing in the world doing, and that was a long time. And then when that 9 years of theatre without theatre came to an end, and I started doing it again, then I was pretty busy. Not always in great jobs, but always interesting jobs anyway.
Has being unemployed gotten easier with time? in terms of how it affects your mood or thinking specifically emotionally and mentally rather than economically.
It must have because I finished this play at the Vaults last November, and then it was pretty quiet for the rest of the winter. And then I remember on the 2nd of March, auditions started coming in, and I thought, thank fuck, it's spring, new beginning, you know. And by the end of March, of course, we were in lockdown, and that was that. And I'm perversely okay in my head at the moment, so it must have got easier. But I think, again, something which they didn't teach at drama school then, and I'm sure they do now, is preparing people for the fact that they should really have to seek another job as well. And that's not a cop-out, and it's not it might be a compromise, but it's also a necessity. If you've got something else in your life other than just hopes.
I think the drama schools are starting to do this thing, and I think it's really positive change, but also it doesn't quite get to where you're talking about, which is drama schools do this thing about, from my chats that I've had, about making your own work being important. But of course, we all know that making your own work doesn't necessarily mean making your own money. And that quite often it can mean the opposite. You can end up not being able to work your part-time job for a period if you're really flat out with rehearsals or developing something or doing shows in above a pub or in a small theatre for very little. But actually, it's great if making your own work leads to you being artists in residence and at, you know, a nice big venue. But actually, it's another kind of false promise, isn't it? You got to make your own work. It's make your own work to be spotted, I guess, would be the kind of more realistic, so somebody else will hire you. But it doesn't really get to what you're saying, which is that accepting that as part of this career is the acceptance that it's not a career in traditional way. It's not a career. It's not a career where, you know, if you find yourself stacking shelves in Sainsbury's, that's somehow a failure.
Yeah, it's not a failure. It's just you've got to find something to mentally and financially keep things ticking over. Otherwise,
mental things really important.
People
underestimate the importance of that as well, don't they?
Yeah, it's got to be something you find, if not creative, then at least ethically satisfying.
Really fucking brilliantly paid would also do.
I remember posting leaflets through letterboxes as I was coming to the end of a stint at the National Theatre, and I thought, this is fucking ridiculous. But
I used to love that contradiction. When that contradiction played out to its best, I used to love it. When we were in the National, going and doing labouring stuff.
Yeah.
And with a big beard and a shaved head. But, what's the story of the beard? I'm on a show on the National. And they'd be like, yeah, whatever, dickhead. And you're like, no, I am. I'm an actor. And they're like, yeah, whatever, dickhead. And I used to love that kind of, that you're doing what you do, what you love doing, but it includes doing a little bit of the things that you don't.
And doesn't that say an awful lot about people's perceptions, that if you're working at the National Theatre, you can't possibly have the need to do anything else? It's like if you say to someone you're going on a tour and they say, oh, do all the hotels get boring, do they? I'm like, you think you stay in hotels? Are you fucking kidding? It's digs and I've got to arrange it weeks in advance and it's horrible.
Yeah.
You know, but okay, you think it's hotels. That's fine.
I'm not going to disavow you that, you know, absolutely. So have you acquired any specific ways, not drinking aside, of coping with rejection and unemployment and the economic uncertainties?
I don't know. I mean, God, that's difficult. I think rejection, if you can turn it around and somehow understand the bigger picture, that it's not just about you, maybe there is someone else who's better for the part, you know, that's tough. But of course we think we're always the best people for the role, but we might not be. It's difficult to hang on to those, or not hang on to them, I should say. So I don't know if I've dealt with that, but I do think the problem is the compromise that I've made is that in order to cope with that better, I have probably become less ambitious. It's that old, is it Pete Postlethwaite who said, you know, the key thing to acting is don't want it?
Yeah. Which actually I don't, because I've got to that point as well where I'm not sure I've stopped caring, but I certainly tell myself that.
Yeah.
Regularly. Yeah. And
that's
actually
impossible.
But there was a part of me that used to email my agent and say, listen, is there anybody I should be contacting? Is there anybody you're having difficulty getting me in with that I could write to? And then coming up, you think I should need to write to, but I need to be really good. And I got to the point where he was just saying, no, you're fine, because everybody knows who you are. You get to that point in your career where if they've seen you, they like you, or they don't, and they're either going to see you or not see you again. It's like, yeah. It gets that simple, right?
Yeah.
But interestingly, big Matthew Flynn said something in like episode 3, which has come back to me, which is, you know, he phones like people he's worked with in the past to remind them he exists. And or at least he did when he did the interview, and he would get involved in, you know, nights with young directors, because he's always thinking like, yeah, those young directors are going to become established directors at some point, and I want to be the guy. So he was still very much in that place of finding, connecting, building relationships. And I haven't done that for years. I've quite happily been lazy with the excuse that I don't really care. But in actual fact, I think I do care as much, but not doing those things is my coping mechanism, because it removes the ability to be rejected, or reduces the opportunity for rejection if I feel like I'm in control.
The most depressing moment I had with an agent was during, I think, that those 9 years of not very much. And I rang my agent just to sort of have that conversation, which you know, the subtext of which is, I want a job and please, can you get me one? And of course it's, who can I be calling? Who can I be writing to? Just seeing what's going on, all that stuff. And, you know, had the conversation. It was toe curly in the extreme. Put the phone down. Within, I mean, this might have even been before emails, but within a couple of hours, he had an audition for me. And I thought, oh, fuck, you've just remembered I exist, haven't you? Oh, shit.
What was it for?
You know, I was nothing. And I rang you and you went, oh, I'd better get him something so he thinks I'm still here.
Yeah, that I mean, there are people who would say that that is one of the most important things you can do is phone those guys and say, listen, I exist.
Yeah.
But my point would be, like, if you need to do that, you shouldn't be with the agent in the first place.
I agree 100%. The agent I'm with at the moment, I would never, ever need to do that, because I know she's working her ass off all the time.
Yeah, there needs to be an element of trust, that you trust that they're doing it anyway. I just think you never want to be that actor where they have... I have caller ID installed because of you.
Yeah, right. No, but God, it's funny.
There's nothing worse. The worst thing you can get from an agent is a sense of pity. I've had that in the past, and that's the thing that always hurts the most, because if they pity you and they know the reality, they know who they're submitting you to. Like, I always think pity is that I'll take anything. I'll take anger. I'll take frustration. But whenever they're like, are you okay? You know, I just, oh no, don't go there.
Yeah, yeah, I know.
What's the most difficult thing about being an actor, Luke?
I think it's a really difficult thing to demand of your nearest and dearest, actually. I've never been able to live off this career. I've never been able to say to my wife and my children, you know, you're okay, because I'm bringing in the money. And that makes me feel... That has made me feel pretty shitty over the years. Because if your job is not able to do that, then it can be quite debilitating, don't you think?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, yeah, 100%. But I guess the question would be, you must have been able to give other things then.
True. Yeah, that is true.
And I remember speaking to, who was it in series one? Michael? Anyway, somebody who'd had kids and had said the same thing, that they basically took 10 years and looked after the kids and were their kids' court jester, I think was the term. And that actually that is knowing how to play is some serious bread on the table in another way. you know?
Yeah, you're absolutely right. That is true.
Mm. At least you're present.
Completely. And that, if you are parenting, that those years are over so quickly. So, so quickly. I have a friend of mine who's an actor who has just had his first child, you know, and he was saying to me, he can't wait to...
You can name me. It's okay. You can name me.
they're both actors and et cetera, and they've just had their first child, and it's not you. And he was saying, you know, we're juggling, this is pre-COVID-19, but it's, you know, we're juggling whose turn it is to work and things like that. And he was sort of hinting at the fact that he can't wait till he's old enough that they can get back to normal slightly and do jobs and things like that. And I just said, look, don't wish it away, because this stuff is over in a heartbeat. And in terms of quality time that you get with your kids, that is over so quickly. It's just shocking. You know, I mean, my daughter's 25 and my son's about to be 18. That means I won't have any children anymore. They'll both be adults. And that seems to have been over very, very quickly. And I was talking to my daughter about this the other day, and she said...
How quick? Like very quickly?
Well, it's astonishing.
Like really quickly? Really quickly?
Yeah. I mean, chronologically, of course, it's a set amount of years, but it feels quick. And
the sooner I go to bed tonight, the sooner it'll be over. Is that what you're saying?
Depends on the substances you're imbuing. I don't know. I mean, my daughter was saying to me the other day that, you know, I was not particularly present for a part of her childhood. And then I was, and she wasn't saying it critically. She was, you know, she was saying I was so much more present, but by that, she meant that there was a point that I wasn't. And that this career can do that, you know. It can suck the presence of you in someone else's life out. I mean, those year-long tours are the tough ones. I've done a couple of them. And that's a huge, huge thing to ask of the other people in your life.
I remember that at the time.
Yeah.
Watching that from the outside, and you'd done a little project online with your map.
Oh yeah,
and for your son to follow.
That's right. God.
That you were at least making the effort, I guess.
Yeah,
right?
That was me trying to show him, look what daddy's doing. This is exciting. I'm going here and then I'm going there. And, you know, and he was 13 or so at the time. He was quite interested. Plus he for a brief moment wanted to be an actor. And so that was all quite entertaining, but
I was getting some good work as well.
Yeah, I know, really. Yeah, God, you remember.
Yeah.
But the one before that, he was 7, and I really thought, fuck, what am I doing? I mean, to bring this back to where we came in, 7's the age that I went off to boarding school. And when I tell people that, they go, fuck, that was young. That's not right. And I'm thinking, well, it's also the age that I said to my son, I'm going on a year-long tour around the country. I've been around every day for you for 7 years, and I'm still your dad, but I need to work. Bye. That was tough.
So, you know, this is interesting, this need to work, right? You've always struck me as someone who keeps busy, and that is both within and without the industry, don't like to be someone who sits at home not making money. So you'll go and do other jobs to bring money in when you're not working as an actor. Do you find that difficult, in a sense that, you know, I look sometimes whenever Bruno and I, our incomes would fluctuate wildly, and sometimes 2 or 3 years I would make more money, and then sometimes 2 or 3 years Bruno would make more money, and it turns out at the moment we're in one of the latter kind of periods where actually I worked out a couple of years ago that I could go get a job in a bar, but the money I would make, I'm more use at home doing the dishes, keeping the I'm more actual use as a PA to Bruno when she's busy, then I would be bringing in £7 an hour, right? Or £8 an hour working in a bar. Yeah. And so I made a decision a few years ago when Bruno was getting really busy with writing that need to work was my need. It wasn't a financial need. It was a need for me to get out of the house. And that for me, the decision was a different one, I think, than yours, which was, I just need to accept that I'm going to clean, and I'm going to... do the garden, and I'm going to do things, I'm going to do chores so that Bruno has more time to write.
Yeah.
Is that something you've ever felt in terms of, you know, do you do those jobs purely for the financial need, or do you do them because you need to feel like you're contributing?
I think the latter. And I think I've taught myself to become that, because when I left drama school, I could have done with a bit of that. And then, I mean, the most ludicrous point was probably about 15 years ago when I was teaching drama, and my son was very young. He was under five. He's been like three or four, I think. And we had to pay someone to look after him while I was teaching. And it was pretty much like for like. And my wife covered it and said, you know, it's important that you are able to feel you're doing something. But that was, as you say, that was more about my need to not feel guilty that I was bringing something in or being active than any kind of sensible notion of economic balance, because there wasn't any. It was ridiculous. I would have been probably much better just staying at home and looking after him myself. But it seemed like the right decision at the time. And it's, with a bit of hindsight, it seems sort of futile, really. I suppose what you're saying, and I think what you're saying, and I think I agree with it, is that you need to be able to say to yourself, my presence here is of value, and the skills that I'm bringing to the table or the environment are valuable, even if they're not financially, you know, remunerative.
Have you ever considered giving up?
Oh, yeah.
How seriously and how close have you got?
Just before we worked together, about a year before that, I think, my part-time job, which was not particularly interesting, but it was in retail, and it was something I could do, there was an opportunity for that to become a bit more. And they said, look, we think you're really good at what you do. We'd like you to accept a higher position within this company. But if you do it, you can't be juggling acting as well.
I think that's a very common experience people will identify with.
Well, I said to my agent at the time, look, nothing's happened much recently. What do you think about doing this? Just see how it goes. And we agreed, I think it was 2 or 3 months where they wouldn't actually call me. Well, they wouldn't actively put me up for anything. If something came in with an offer or something, then we'd worry about that if it happened. But I would work, you know, and that was the only time I've ever done a Monday to Friday job. I started to put great stock in things like Friday night, you know, that.
I understand the weekend for the first time.
Completely. And I didn't like it either, but I'd much rather be walking past a restaurant on a Saturday afternoon and having just done a show and be about to do another one than wish I was inside with those people having the quote unquote normal life. But doing that job I was not happy, but I had to get out of it to realize how unhappy I was.
It's interesting. I used to always think this when I moved to London and I worked in a restaurant and occasionally would get offered, you know, do you want to become a supervisor or take a step up, and always turned it down. There'd be other actors as well who would do the same thing. We offered a friend of mine, Maren Owen, who's now teaches acting, and we were asked, would we like to share the manager's job? And we both turned it down and we said, no, they still couldn't understand why we wouldn't share a manager's job. But I always said that London is full of restaurant managers and retail managers. And you go into those jobs and you meet your manager and you say, I'm an actor. And they go, so am I. And you do that thing of look at them and go, well, you can't be, you're the manager. And the truth is they've been in London 10 years and somehow by accident, they've become the manager of Topshop in Oxford Street. Or by accident, they become, you know, the manager of a massive restaurant in Soho. And the reason is because they were always available and they're good at what they do and they're really, you know, intelligent and personable and people like them and they're good with, you know, a team and all those transferable skills that actors have. But it is one of those things where I think it's a decision. You'd be strong and just say no, kids, you know.
Yeah, yeah. Because sorry about my dog barking in the background, by the way. I don't know if that's coming through, but anyway.
It is, yeah, it's beautiful.
Yeah, it's a bit of homely touch. It's just the postman, Christ. It's not that exciting, but he gets very excited. Yeah, because all those skills that may not come second nature to actors, but certainly are skills that we have, if you put them in another environment, they're incredibly valuable.
Mm-hmm.
You know, confidence. I mean, I was
communication. You
know, I worked in telephone fundraising for a while.
Christ, you did.
I mean, you know, that was fucking depressing. But again,
you
I didn't
got
realize
me in.
That,
you got me in. I was
so sorry. I know, but it wasn't until I got out that I realized what a poison chalice it was.
I raised money for the Society for the Prevention of Animals. Something.
I've forgotten. For
donkeys.
That to you.
I raised money for donkeys, and I had to, in my first shift, my first after training, my first paid shift, I had to raise my hand and say, take my headphones off and say, I'm out.
Like,
there was a big like, what do you mean? And they brought me in the room, like, what do you mean? And it was because I was trying to sell something, trying to sell charity to a woman who was breastfeeding her baby. And she said the line to me, listen, I'm actually in the middle of breastfeeding my baby. And true to script, I said, it really is a very quick call. And as soon as it came out of my mouth, I thought, I do not like this. This is not who I am.
I've done that enough times to hear that and not laugh at it.
It really is a very quick call. I'm breastfeeding my child. I don't know if you just heard that. Oh, yeah, sorry. I'm sorry. I should. Yes, absolutely. You should go and do that. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. Oh, grim.
That, you know, that itself is a skill to be able to say, you know, no way am I going to talk to you about this right now. Bye. But I mean, you know, within that area, for example, you've got people like you and me who understand rejection. And you're also trying to read a script. Don't want to give away too many trade secrets here, but of course you're reading
the script. I know the script off my heart. Is there one day?
Yeah, you knew the script, and your job is to make the script come alive and make people emotionally react to it. So of course that's the same as acting.
That's how you sold it to me. That's how you sold. This is the danger.
I'm so sorry.
This is how you sold it to me. It's just acting. You're trying to elicit an emotional response was the phrase you used. I remember it as clear as day. And that was also, you got me at a low point because that was whenever I was just about fed up with working, laboring. I was working in a bar at night. And at one point I was doing all three. So I was doing laboring, bar and that and pub quizzes. No, it's not your fault, but it was.
Sorry.
Hi, you recently donated to our campaign on television. You gave £3. I just was phoning today to say thank you very much and just let you know a little bit more about what we're doing.
Yeah.
Would that be okay? Great. So as you know, some animals across the world are living in unconscionable conditions. It's true that in some places in South America, donkeys' harnesses are made out of barbed wire. Can you imagine how painful that must be for those poor animals? So we're actually using your money to help stop that happening.
Just getting my wallet out, sorry.
Et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah.
I mean, that was basically the general thrust. People were getting UNICEF. And I got protecting donkeys overseas. That's what I got.
Yeah, they would have built you up.
UNICEF. There was a guy beside me who was on UNICEF. I was like that lucky bastard.
I did not for UNICEF. I mean, but you know, to be serious, that was when that worked, it was a wonderful job. Felt great to be raising money for UNICEF. But yeah, my point was within that arena of that job, the skills that people like you and me had are going to set us on a ladder because you know we are good at rejection. We are good at being emotive. We are good at dealing with scripts.
Thanks, man.
You know, all that stuff. So sooner or later, someone's going to say, do you want to be a manager? And you have to go, well, as much as I like this job, sometimes the reason I'm here is because I can go off and do auditions at less than 24 hours.
It's true. And sometimes the offer's too good.
Nope.
Yeah. But I know so many people who've come over or come to London from other places and within 3 years, they're managing a restaurant. But not just because they've been offered, but because also the financial pressures are so huge that the extra fucking, sometimes the extra 50p or £1 an hour, which is all it usually is so significant if you're working 50 hours a week, like 200 and whatever quid a month extra, that people can't turn it down. And I know what that's like, you know?
Yeah.
But yeah, you just have to be strong, I think.
I wouldn't be an actor if it wasn't for the fact that my wife earns okay money. It's as simple as that. I would have had to chuck this in and do something else a long, long time ago.
Yeah, but that's why you married her. if you weren't an actor...
No, it is not. I can't believe you said that. Even the dog disagrees with that
one. If you weren't an actor, what would you be?
Oh. I'm going to let my dog fill the pause. I'm not answering that doorbell. I'm not Paul Higgins. I haven't set up someone to pick up the delivery in
my
case
daughter.
He goes during the recording. Yeah. I don't know. I would quite fancy, and this is ridiculous because I don't know, I was talking to my father-in-law about this the other day, and he's in his 70s, and he still talks about what he'd like to do one day. So I don't think that ever leaves you. I think I can still, I could maybe imagine myself as a writer or something.
Music journalist.
Maybe. I don't know. I quite enjoy the solitary writer's life. I'm okay with that. But that's just a...
See, you have yourself down as this misanthrope, and it's not what I remember at all. I remember a man at the front of the queue to complete a jigsaw, communal jigsaw. I remember a man whose curtain was always open.
It wasn't a small part I had in that play. There was a lot of backstage time.
A lot of backstage chats. So why haven't you given up? What's the best thing about being an actor?
Why haven't I given up? I love doing it. And as long as I'm able to do it, I'm going to carry on. But I don't complacently say that I will never give up, because, you know, something, particularly right now, who knows what comes out at the end of this. But
theatres are literally burning as we speak.
I must remember, Jonathan doesn't read the news. Don't speak in metaphor. Yeah. You know,
I hate that I don't read the news. I used to always, I just can't anymore. And I sometimes see it by accident and it makes me really cross. And I think it's satire and then I realize it's not. And that makes me even more cross.
There's a balance to be struck though. Because the news is bad for your mental health. There's no doubt about that. But also shutting yourself out is similarly harmful. So you just have to be, you know, find a routine that works for you. You read the news in the morning, maybe once in the afternoon, not just before you go to bed. I mean, my wife and I were watching Channel 4 News the other night, and my son came in and he went, "I don't know how you watch that and then go to sleep."
Which is a fair point.
I mean, it's a fair point. And also Channel 4 News is on quite early. That must be, he thinks we go to bed really early. What are we talking about? News, doing something else. What was the question again?
I said, what's the best thing? Was that the question? Who cares anymore? No one's listening at this point. Well, they've all decided.
We're just riffing now.
It's two middle-aged white men talking shit. We're basically 90%
for a podcast. Yeah,
we're 90% of podcasts out there.
Fuck! It's depressing, isn't it?
Do you consider yourself successful?
No.
Would your younger self agree with that? The younger self that was going into drama school, how would he judge your achievements?
Well, my younger self would be shocked that after a quarter of a century plus, you still haven't made it. My younger self was so naive. My younger self had no idea that the employed, unemployed, no momentum equation still exists.
So let's take making it as an expression out of the picture. Okay. How do you define success?
It's got to be that very unoriginal answer, which I'm sure lots of your guests have said, which is not being able to have to rely on another job and being able to live off this one. Because then it's a career, then it's a trade. And then whatever worth you find in it beyond that is fantastic, but it can't just be the worth that you find in a job if it doesn't actually tick the box of job, i.e. financially help you exist.
Okay. So if you could, with this wisdom that you now have, Lucas Herr, after a quarter of a century of, you know, living with it, and all that it is, it's good and it's bad. If you could go back to that arrogant young fool that was, it sounded like crap's last tip all of a sudden. If you could go back, oh, what an idiot I was then, and offer your younger self advice, have a word in his ear, what might you say to him to illuminate that dark and winding path, to make it more straight, to use a biblical reference?
Well, I would say either lower your expectations / curb your enthusiasm, or go 100% in the other direction. Be very, very ambitious and don't take no for an answer. But what you can't do is just exist somewhere in the middle. Well, you can, because I have, but I think my younger self thought it was all going to happen, but never really had the drive to make sure it happened.
Okay.
I don't think I was ambitious enough, you know.
If, as Baz Luhrmann tells us, advice is a way of taking the past, dusting it off, and recycling it for more than it's worth, Hindsight is the thing that's brought you to that advice, right?
Yes, that's true.
The things that you regret. So what would that younger man with no sense of the future, in his relative ignorance, remind you of that you may, in those intervening years, have forgotten?
Well, I don't know. My younger self might try and give my older self some advice, but it would be advice without the context of experience. And my older self would know that it was naive, unrealistic nonsense. I don't know.
So to put that question another way, do you think there's anything of that young man that you've lost that you wish you could get back?
No, I'm happy with who I am now than I was then. I think. No, I know I am.
Just gonna leave a pause there for you to doubt yourself.
Bastard.
Okay, final question. Do you second last penultimate question? Do you worry more about your health, your work, or your financial security?
I think health now. You know, I'm now older than my mum was when she died, which happened to me when I was quite young. I am very aware that I should eat better, exercise a bit, not drink, things that I do, actually. I'm not obsessed by my health, but I do think it's something to keep an eye on. Work and financial security are always going to be important, but the older I get, I tend to keep more of an eye on my health, I think, mental and physical, probably more mental.
Particularly in the context of a global pandemic.
Well, yeah, there is that.
Listen, last question. Are you in anything and I'm going to change this for you, the moment, because that's the way that seems to be more common in the English.
I'm so touched that you changed that with me, because I always used to say at the moment, at the moment, at the moment.
Are you in anything at the moment?
No, I'm just in my house. Sorry, I stole that joke. I stole that. I've got to say where I stole it from. There's a great podcast called The Guilty Feminist. And years ago, they had Phoebe Waller-Bridge on it.
Yep.
And she was talking about her hatred of social media and how bad it is for you and how it just turns us all into, you know, closet, not even closet, narcissists and, you know, bores and God knows what. And at the very end of the podcast, the host, Deborah Francis White, always used to say, where can people find you? And they would say, well, I'm on Twitter at @LucasUnderscoreHair or whatever. I'm on Facebook is and whatever. And Phoebe Waller-Bridge spends an hour lambasting social media, and Deborah Francis White said to her, so where can people find you? And she just went, my house? Which I thought was just perfect. So no, I'm nicking that joke. I am not.
But also on Twitter.
Yeah, I'm also on Twitter. But I'm just in my house waiting for, looking for the next best thing, as Warren Zevon said.
It has been a pleasure, Lucas_Hair.
I'm not on that anymore.
It has been a pleasure, Lucas. Long overdue. Thank you very much for your time and your honesty. And I hope it's maybe reminded you of some things that you might have forgotten about, but my sense is that you have been writing your autobiography because your answers were so eloquent that you couldn't possibly have been thinking on your feet. There's definitely some prompt cards being involved here. There's somebody standing.
I had to do some preparation. I was fucking terrified. I was so nervous. The minute I said yes, I thought, oh shit. Because podcasts are really easy.
Well, I just dropped you in it. You see, it just really dropped you in it.
Well, but podcasts are easy if you're the host, but if you're the guest, it's all about you. Then that's quite a pressure. But you've made it very pleasurable, and thank you. It's been an honour to partake.
It's been an honour. The honour, sir, has been all mine. That was the Honest Actors podcast with Jonathan Harden and Lucas Hare.
That was so perfect. I wanted to laugh in the middle of that. I thought, no, you use this shit. This is good.
No, hold on. Where is it? Next time on Honest Actors. So just showing off, all I can do there, if anybody's hiring, there's literally no point in showing off your range in this podcast because we are all unemployed actors after all. So people are more likely to take jobs from you than give them to you. Is that true? I don't know. So that was Lucas Hare talking about 2 weeks ago. I obviously didn't put that out as quickly as I'd like to because of various other things that had got in the way of that. So thanks again to Luke for doing it and apologies to him for the delay in getting it out. I said on the Thursday night that we recorded that it was going to go out the following day, and that's 2 weeks ago. So things didn't quite go to plan. Thanks again for listening. If you're on Twitter, you can find me there at honestactors at Jonathan Harden. Please do suggest future interviewees. Please let me know how you think it's going, what your favourite bits are, any quotes that stand out, any moments that you've enjoyed, or anything you just think is total bullshit. I'm always interested to hear what you guys think. That's it for now, I guess. Until next time, take care of yourselves and each other. Thanks for listening. Speak to you soon.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here, and it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.